The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Richard Freeman joins me on this episode as we hear about the recent expedition to Tajikistan by the Center for Fortean Zoology, searching for the Caspian Tiger. Once straddling the Euro-Asian border regions, the Caspian Tiger was allegedly hunted to extinction by the turn of 2003. Yet people are still claiming to both see and encounter the tiger in this region, and Richard gives us the lowdown on the CFZ's third expedition there. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patrons, Brianna and Danny Boy, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your generous contributions. It means a great deal, and thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit our exclusive merchandise store via TeePublic. The link is in the show notes as always. And thank you for the recent purchase of some t-shirts from you lovely listeners. It's greatly appreciated. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. The Republic of Tajikistan is our destination now, in the company of Richard Freeman. Tajikistan is a landlocked country in Central Asia with some of the most stunning vistas available in that continent. Yet it is also home to alleged mysterious creatures, the hominid known as the ghoul, which certain regions seems to be very familiar with the residents, and the continued search for the allegedly extinct Caspian tiger intrigue many an explorer to its realms. Freshly returned from his latest expedition out there, I'm delighted to welcome back our old friend, Richard Freeman. Richard, welcome.
Nice to be back, mate.
So, I mean, it's one of those things, Richard. I think we've all been very hectic over the last few years anyway, in general. But this year, for you, especially my man, it seems to be one of the busiest years you've ever had, knowing you as long as I have now, with numerous books and expeditions and conferences and speaking engagements. You are a man in demand, it seems, Richard.
Yeah, well, I've had a couple of books out, and I've got another on the way and two more in the pipeline. I only did the one expedition this year to Tajikistan, but we've got others in the pipeline as well. Yeah, I've done a few talks up and down the country, so I haven't done too badly.
Yes, I have to say, whenever I see one of my friends announced on a pretty big event, Richard, I always feel a sense of pride these days. And especially for someone such as yourself, who's been as generous with their time and their assistance over the years to me and the show, buddy. I was chuffed to bits when I saw the lineup for the upcoming Uncanny Con down in London next month, and saw that you are going to be on there as sort of the resident cryptid expert, which is remarkable. Yeah. So congratulations, mate.
Yeah, I mean, I love Uncanny in all its forms. I love the podcast. I love the TV show. The book was fantastic. And it's really wonderfully entertaining and open-minded, and it unearths new cases you've never heard of. And it's great all round. So I'm delighted to be asked along. I'm apparently going to be on an expert's Q&A, although no one's really an expert in this field of Fortiana. There's no such thing as an expert because it's all mystery. So it's we're all toilers in the groves of Fortiana. And apparently they're doing a Uncanny University challenge as well, which I'm going to be involved with. So I'm wondering if the presenter is going to be Bamba Ghost Coin.
I'm wondering if you're going to be representing Scumbag College, Richard.
Oi, up Scumbag!
Yes, I was trying to explain that particular episode to a very young person I work with, who's just discovered the young ones, Richard, and it's remarkable that here we are. It's 40 years since the young ones had its zenith on the BBC, that somebody in their mid-20s has still discovered them. And so that episode will always live long in my memory with Vivian's specialist round on Toxteth O'Grady, the world bogey champion.
The holder of the record for most marshmallows stuck up one nostril, and who produced the world's stickiest bogey.
Oh, so how did that come along then, Richard? Was that through mutual acquaintances and friends that you were asked to join the panel?
It was pretty much out of the blue. I wrote to him, to Danny Robbins, and said, look, if you want to do anything on cryptozoology and stories, you know, I'm your man, because sometimes you've got to blow your own trumpet. But the English aren't very good at doing that, blowing their own trumpets, but occasionally you have to. And I said, you know, I've done these expeditions, I've been researching for well over 20 years. And he said, yeah, we'd love to do cryptozoology, but we haven't found the right story yet. We haven't found a story that sort of affected someone's life long term. The story's about people seeing things, but it's not affected their life long term. And when they did the North American one, they did find someone who'd been, some Native Americans who'd been in Alaska, had been attacked by rock-curling Sasquatches. And I commented on that, and he read my comment out, because it was the very lame, half-arsed skeptic they had in was saying it was bears.
Yes.
These bears that have faces like gorillas, outward jutting scapulae, walk around on their hind legs and can pick up and hurl rocks with opposable thumbs. Yeah. So he mentioned that. And I met them when they did Uncanny Live and had a bit of a chat with them. So I think it was on the back of that. So I'm hoping to get more involved in it. If this goes well, I hope they ask me back, you know, onto the show and stuff, and do some more cryptozoology. And also I'm going to explain that I don't just do straight cryptozoology, because if you're painting with very broad strokes, monsters fall into two categories. You've got your true cryptids, which are unknown animals, creatures unknown to science, creatures we thought were extinct but maybe still be around, and known animals that have grown immensely big. And then you've got your paranormal stuff, into which you get dragons, Mothman, Owlman, Monday werewolf sightings, Monday fairy sightings, troll sightings, things like that. So there's a paranormal aspect to monsters as well. Even though my work is mostly with flesh and blood animals, apart from Monday dragon sightings, which is something that totally fascinates me.
Well, I think this is the thing sometimes when the term cryptozoology is mentioned or said sometimes with disdain by those that view it very dimly, Richard, that essentially there's a lot of real animals that have existed that fall under the pantheon of this. Obviously, most people will, you know, and as we've mentioned previously, the Tasmanian wolf, the Tasmanian tiger, is probably the most well-known example of such things. But obviously, you've done expeditions in regards to searching for lost tigers. We've got lost apes. We've got seals that are often brought forwards as kind of falling under this umbrella that people still see these strange things. Giant birds. There are all kinds of things that we have in the fossil record that even into the modern era, we're still getting fleeting reports all around the world of where these allegedly extinct animals are still being spotted.
Absolutely. What I don't like, though, is when people sort of put transparently fictional paranormal things in with cryptozoology. So you see these lists of cryptids and they've got things like Slenderman and the Rake, and which are all made up things from the internet. And then they have their things like the Fresno night crawlers,
yes,
as cryptid as well. By people who don't understand what a cryptid actually is.
Yes, the lines have become blurred, especially in this modern era of social media, Richard. And sometimes I've given up being annoyed by crap cryptid posts because I think you could waste far too much time. But it's a prime example of this. I mean, this week I was watching the latest edition of Expedition X. And they were in Michigan looking at all these dogman sightings. And it was a bit, I have to say, even as somebody as open-minded as I am and somebody who has had the pleasure of speaking with both Linda Godfrey and Chad Lewis, primarily dealing with the Beast of Bray Road and the dogman sightings down there. And when I've spoke to Lyle Blackburn, we've spoken about...
Fantastic research, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And Lyle Blackburn as well in regards to...
Lyle's great and a great author.
Absolutely. And talking about the Loop Guru with him, and I know he's doing his next episode of Monstro Bizarro will be focusing on man wolves of the Midwest. So I would suspect he'll be touching on both Wisconsin and Michigan. And it was one of those things that they had a witness on who told this incredible story, Richard. And as someone that defends cryptid witnesses often, I have to say I was very dubious. And then they got an alleged dogman expert on who I'd never heard of. Now, I'm not pretending to know everybody who claims to research these particular subjects. I'd never heard of this chap ever. And he was like, oh, yeah, it's all military graded hybridization programs. And there's thousands of them running around in the woods of the Midwest and they're eating people. And I just thought, OK, buddy. Right. We are.
If there's anything to these things, they are paranormal in nature.
Absolutely.
There's nothing in the evolutionary record like that. There's no evolutionary pressures for canids to become bipedal. And they're not even anything like the actual medieval stories of werewolves. Nothing like them.
Yeah, very much so. It strikes me as well, because obviously, you know, our friend who we both got to know over recent years, Paul Sinclair, and his Wolflands documentary, Richard, I think... Paul was very good in the fact that he's not telling people there's werewolves running around northeast England. You know, Paul's very similar to what you just said there in regards to this kind of supernatural spectral element to most of these. And I think Wolflands that he did, and he's currently filming the sequel at the moment with Les and some of his other colleagues out there, that a lot of these stories are very odd in that kind of aspect, that there seems to be something more ghostly about a lot of these encounters, Richard, rather than the physical attributes that some of the dogman stories from Michigan and Wisconsin seem to have a bit more sort of grounding in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they do. And of course, there was a very famous composer that researched dogmen as well, Bach.
Oh, we can only raise the bar from this point on, Richard. So going back to your expedition that you've recently returned from, how many times have you been out to Tajikistan now, Richard? Because I think this is one of those places that when we spoke about it, I think a couple of years ago, we did an episode talking all about the ghoul. But I know obviously you've been there previously. So was this your second or third trip out there?
This was the third trip out there. Now, the first trip was concentrating mainly on the ghoul, which was the Tajik name for the wild man, which seems slightly different to the Russian Almasty. It seems smaller, has a different hound structure, and it seems more aggressive. But the Soviet Snowman Commission sent expeditions to Tajikistan. In the book Soviet Sasquatch from CSZ Press, we got hold of Boris Prozhnev's notes and correspondences, and there was a lot of Prozhnev himself, amongst others, went to Tajikistan in the 50s and 60s looking for these things. And we met a lot of witnesses who had seen them very recently and even been attacked by them. And the tiger was sort of a secondary thing, but we were surprised to find out how many people had seen reported Caspian tigers. And the Caspian tigers, a subspecies of tiger that used to range from Western China to Eastern Turkey throughout Central Asia. And its scientific name was Panthera tigris zygata. And it was supposed to have been hunted to extinction, the last one being shot around 1970. It was similar to the Siberian tiger. It was a cold-adapted tiger. It was very big, second only to the Siberian tiger in size. It had very long, bushy hair to protect it from the cold. Most people associate tigers with the tropics, but they evolved in a cooler climate and then moved down into the tropics. And it was well known. It's been written about for centuries. It appears in Roman murals and things like that. But in the 20th century, it was hunted. Its prey species were hunted. And a lot of the habitat was lost. And it was thought that it died out around 1970. But there's been sporadic sightings ever since. And there were, about 10 years ago, there were a load of sightings from the east of Turkey. But when we were there the first time, we met a park ranger who had seen one a month to the day before we arrived, and he'd watched it for about 5 minutes. We met hunters who had had their kills taken by the Caspian tiger. We met farmers who had livestock taken and seen the tiger. Beekeepers, of which there are an abundance in Tajikistan, up in the mountains, that had seen it. We talked to imams in a mosque, and they all knew it was there, and they told us stories about people seeing these things, even alleged photographs taken, but they'd never come to light. But everybody we spoke to had either seen a Caspian tiger, or knew someone that had seen them, so they were just accepted. When we went there a second time, the stories about the ghoul we got were all pretty old. They were the most recent ones were from the 1970s, but we got loads of contemporary tiger sightings from within the last year. So this time around, we decided to concentrate on the tiger. So myself, Dr. Chris Clark and John Hare went, a group of three. And we had a great guide called Hassan. And we went along the Romit Valley, because the two forks of the Romit Valley, which is where we went on the first expedition. The second expedition, we went to another valley, the Karatag Valley mainly, and it wasn't so good there. It was the quality of witnesses weren't so good. The habitat wasn't so good. So we ended up, for the last few days of that expedition, going back to the Romit Valley, which is where we got some good sightings from. So we went back to the two forks of the Romit Valley again, and we went to the upper fork first. And we visited this village called Pushkov and spoke to several witnesses and locals. We talked to a man called Pfizer. He had never seen a tiger or a gull, but he had seen snow leopards in the mountains. Another man we talked to was called Shirley, and he invited us in for tea and told us what he knew. He said he'd not seen the tiger or the gull, but he'd heard that there were tigers found in the high mountains. So the first two people we spoke to, they hadn't seen a gull or a tiger. Another old man told us that leopards kill sheep and attack shepherds, and but he had never seen a tiger. So we went on to a second village further up the valley, the village of Koshkiv. And there was a man who wouldn't give us his name. He was sort of reticent to talk about things. And that's very odd, because I found the Tajiks have been generally very open and very hospitable, and, you know, they like to talk about things. This guy was really cagey. He said that he had seen a tiger in the mountains the year before when he was walking with friends, but he didn't seem to want to talk about it. We spoke to another man called Ani, and he said that he and his friends had seen a tiger when he was walking in the mountains just the year before. And we showed him various pictures of big cats, the leopards, snow leopards, tigers, and he picked the tiger out as definitely the thing he saw. And interestingly, whilst we were in this village, we saw an old skull of a big carnivore, and it was on a post, a fence post stuck into a hedge made out of stone and thorn. And unfortunately, the front of the skull was missing. That's the diagnostic part, because with mammals, the way to tell what a mammal is tooth formula. You look at the different types of teeth in each quadrant of the jaw, the number of them, and each animal will have its own tooth formula. But that part was missing, so there was only the back part of the skull. And the back part of the skull of a bear and a tiger are very similar looking. So we couldn't be sure. But the tiger has a little knob of bone at the back of the skull that bears don't have. And this looked more like a bear to me. Although we took some pictures just to be, you know, so we could take them home and compare them to pictures of bear and tiger skulls. But I was thinking it was probably a bear. We met the only guy we met this time that had seen a ghoul was in this village, and his name was Abdulli, and he was 58. And he'd seen a ghoul back in 1974 when he was 8 with his father. And he said it looked like a hair-covered man, and it was about as tall as an average man, but it was much more muscular with longer arms. And he knew that though it looked like a man, it wasn't a man. And he was very scared. And he looked through various pictures of apes and hominins that we'd brought, and he thought that Homo erectus was the closest thing to what he'd seen. Out of all the pictures, he picked out Homo erectus as being the closest to what he'd seen. And he told us that 50 to 60 years ago, they were seen around the village, but nobody saw them anymore. And it was thought that a ghoul would attack a lone man. And one story he heard about way back when was about a man who'd vanished in the mountains, and he was found dead 2 weeks later. And it was blamed on an attack from a ghoul. But we don't know the details on it, so it could have been anything. It could have been a bear, could have been a tiger. He could have just died of natural causes, but it was blamed on a ghoul. So the belief in the ghoul was still there. So the upper fork of the Romit Valley is much more disturbed than the lower fork. The Chinese have got a load of gold mining interests up there, and they've been opening mines and things, and they've got, you know, factories and living quarters and stuff, and it's very much disturbed, and there's a hell of a lot of traffic going up and down. So we thought we'll go down from there, we'll go down to the lower fork, which is less disturbed. So we decided to go right to the end, as far as we could go, in the lower fork of the Romit Valley, right up into the mountains, where we thought there would be nobody. But we got there, and there was a bunch of soldiers there. There were some barracks several miles further down from where we were. And they were doing exercises there, and they were cutting up firewood with chainsaws, and we thought, bloody hell, they're making so much noise, they'll frighten anything away. It's like, how far do you have to go, you know, to escape civilization? Yes. How far into the wilderness do you have to go now before? I mean, I remember the last time I was up at Gunung Tuju, there was like litter and stuff about, like there would be, in a town park. Yeah. It's getting harder and harder to find deep, true wilderness.
Yes.
You know, where there's no other humans about for miles and miles and miles. I mean, the closest I came to that was Mongolia back in 2005, and where you could travel for days and days and see not a sign of another human being. But we made camp up there, and it was bitterly cold at night. It was bitterly cold because we were further up high, and we were higher than we had been before. And I hate camping at the best of times. I loathe it. As I've said before on this show, anybody that goes camping for fun, they must have something wrong with them mentally. I do it because I have to.
Yeah.
It's a bloody nightmare going to the loo behind a bush, being freezing cold, being uncomfortable. It's bloody, bloody, bloody terrible. Anyway, we travelled to the end of the valley, and we scoped out some places to put camera traps. And we brought a sheep from a local shepherd. And when you're travelling along these narrow roads in the Rumit Valley, sometimes you'll meet flocks of sheep numbering thousands.
Yeah.
Literally, it takes like 20 minutes for them to all go by. So there's thousands and thousands of goats mixed in with them as well. And there's a particular type of sheep there that's bred to have these huge fat arses. Because the way that camels have fat on their humps, these sheep have fat on their arses. So they've got these great big fat Jennifer Lopez type buttocks, which right. look incredibly comical. They're this particular breed of sheep. And we brought one, and I named it Pumpkin for the short time before it was slaughtered. And then we fed off the meat for the next couple of weeks, and some of it we used as bait for the camera traps. And so we went to several different areas. We went to several different areas and set up these camera traps and put the meat around. We also put fruit in case the gull turned up as well.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I was going to say, so when you've done your previous expeditions, Richard, has it all been sort of focused in this particular area? Because I think that the valley is sort of, is it about 50 miles up from the capital city, which is it Dushanbe, I think the capital Tajikistan. So every previous expedition, have you all been in that particular area when you've done them previously?
We've been in that valley, but we've never been that far up. We went right up to where the road peters out and there's nothing but a little trail that goes up into the mountains, and then that's lost in the mountains. This is further than we'd ever been before.
Wow.
Oh, and the sheep, it wasn't called Pumpkin. It was called, that's my mistake, I'm misremembering, it was called Pumpernickel.
Pumpernickel.
I named the sheep Pumpernickel before it got the chop and ended up in our bellies and as bait. So we set up these camera traps. The driver very nicely drove all the way back to Dushanbe with some of my money and got me two camel skin blankets, which are unbelievably comfortable. I use one to lie on and one to cover myself up with because the sleeping bag wasn't doing the job. And they're amazingly comfortable. And when the expedition was finished. We gifted one to the driver and one to the cook. But they are unbelievable. The most comfortable blankets you could imagine, camel skin blankets. They're absolutely fantastic. So my nights were more comfortable after that.
That's a good tip to have in case we need to go abroad again, Richard, that we should always try and pursue some camel blankets.
Well, I usually take a inflatable mattress with me and a little foot pump to make it more comfortable. But I was carrying so much stuff this time, it became impractical, so I had to leave a load of stuff behind. I've got to get a bigger capacity backpack.
Mm.
But, you know, you're weighed down like a mule sometimes. So some of the things I had to leave behind, and one of them was this inflatable bed, inflatable mattress that I have. And it's very comfortable, but it takes up a lot of room in your backpack, even when you try and scrunch it down as small as you can.
Mm. They're deceptively heavy as well, aren't they?
They are, yes. Yeah, they are. And when you've got, like, camera traps and changes of clothes and cameras and other things in it, all starts to weigh down as well.
Yeah.
And I tell you what else is very heavy as well. Plaster of Paris is terribly heavy. It's like concrete. And I've always been amazed that no one stopped me when they've looked in my bag and found a big container of white powder. And no one's batted an eyelid at it.
Yes, I would advise you not to do that if you're going to South America, Richard. So was it a case of setting up camp and then sort of spreading your endeavours in a particular area, Richard, or were you sort of camping, moving?
We stayed in the one area at the end of the valley. Now, the trouble with this is that it was so remote that, unlike other times, we couldn't drive down to nearby villages to interview people because they were just too damn far away. It was so far up the valley because we were trying to avoid disturbance. But the double-edged sword was that you couldn't go and interview people in the numbers that you used to before on previous expedition. And one of the times we were out in this forest up along this pass, and we stumbled on this derelict buildings. They got trees growing through them and stuff, but they weren't ancient, they were fairly new, and we went inside them, and the bathroom had sort of state-of-the-art showers and stuff like you'd find in a 5-star hotel. And Hassan, our guide, said these were originally built as sort of country getaways for government ministers. But there was like a snowfall, and the snow was so heavy it staved the roof in. The roofs collapsed, so they were abandoned. So it's weird to be in the backside of nowhere, find this ruined building that's got all mod cons in it, but they're now all covered with ivy and bushes and stuff like that, which is very odd. Anyway, one of the soldiers who were doing exercise in the area, a guy called Saheed, came to us at breakfast one morning, and he said that the year before he had seen a tiger at the end of the valley, and he was hunting with some friends, and he met the tiger, and the tiger saw the gun, and it recognised what a gun was and fled. That's what he said anyway. It looked at the gun and then fled. And I said that tigers come down at night, and he also saw bears and wolves, but he'd never seen the gull. He'd heard of it, but he'd never seen the gull. So we've got 5 camera traps in all, and we put them in different areas, and we put the bait out. Fruit and the sheep meat. And the other thing, and this is going to sound really strange, Obsession for Men by Calvin Klein.
Yes.
Now, in zoos, experiments in zoos have shown this attracts tigers in the same way that catnip does. Now, I swear to you, I'm not making this up. Go online and there are whole videos about it. There's something in this scent that attracts tigers. So my mate John Hare had brought some of this stuff, as we were going through the airport, and it's not cheap.
No.
So we ended up spraying that around as well, and as well as the camera, as well as the camera traps. So it's, maybe we should use Chanel number 5 next time we go looking for the Yeti.
Yes.
As well as the camera traps, we have these things called glue traps, and they're like sticky things that hair will stick to. If anything goes by and brushes up against it, it'll pull some of the hair out, so you'll get hair samples. So we set these up as well. So we went back to these various places, and we found most of the stuff untouched. The glue trap had caught a mouse, but nothing else had been touched. One of the in the second area, some of the meat from the ground had been removed, but there was no hair on the trap. But everywhere else, everything had been untouched. And in one area, we checked the camera traps, and where the meat had been removed from the floor, we got the back of a wild boar. There were a couple of photographs of that, what is transparently the back of a wild boar roaming around, and it had taken the meat and triggered the camera. Another time we found some odd tracks near the first trap in a sandy area, but they were dog-like but vague. They weren't good enough to truly identify. It wasn't a bear or a big cat, so we don't know what it was. It may have been a wolf, but the tracks weren't good enough to make a 100% diagnosis on that.
I mean, that's an interesting thing when you mention the boar, Richard, because I know one of the reasons put forward for the decline in the population of the Caspian tiger in Tajikistan and in some of its neighbouring countries was the fact that the boar was essentially nearly hunted to extinction there, and that was apparently one of its key food sources. But as you've mentioned earlier,
boars and deer. Yeah.
You were talking about the number of sheep. Now, I've had conversations in the past when we've been talking about big cats in this country and the mysteries that surround them. And I've often heard it said by people that big cats, if they cannot eat sheep, they will tend to ignore them and go after sort of goats or pigs or boars or domestic animals, rather. Is that the case when we're talking about what we consider big cats, Rich, rather than what I'm saying here? Because obviously one of the key reasons that people will sometimes dismiss sheep attacks in this country as being the work of big cats is that alleged preference for something that they don't particularly like, sheep fleece, for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's one thing is they're not supposed to like the fleece of the sheep in their mouth, but there's been enough attacks on domestic livestock to say that yes, they will take sheep from time to time. But the boars have made a great comeback in the area. The first time we were there, we set up camera traps and we got foxes, bears and lots of boar in the Romit Valley. So there's wild boar around there and there's deer as well, so there's plenty for them to eat. Although the farmers say they do lose livestock to them as well.
Well, one would suggest that if the boars are bouncing back, then obviously that's usually a good indication that something else would usually follow it. And I think the big question we've got here is, as you mentioned at the beginning, Richard, about the range of the Caspian tiger being so large, really, is the fact that it wasn't just located in Tajikistan. It was in all the neighbouring countries such as Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and out, as you said, as far west as Turkey. And essentially, I think it was about 12 countries that would consider the Caspian tiger as its native big cat at that period.
What, Western China as well.
Well, yes, because obviously that borders Tajikistan. Yeah. So you would have that, obviously, that overlap there, Richard, as well. So and as we know, despite what certain officials would like to tell us about cats and their range, cats don't know what a border is. They just tend to go wherever the food is.
No animals do. Yeah, they'll just wander over,
because it would suggest that Tajikistan, obviously, because of what it is, and it's got such a low population, and I mean, you've been very fortunate, as you say, to have visited it three times. I think most people either fly over it or go around it, Richard. Not many people go there. It seems to be one of those countries that, since the separation from the old Soviet Union, it's kind of been left behind in comparison to some of the larger countries that surround it. And so do you think this is more to do with the fact that perhaps people are looking in the wrong places, and it is places like Tajikistan and perhaps maybe even further north into Kyrgyzstan and places like that? Because I know there were some claims that I've read in the past about shepherds and hunters in Kyrgyzstan who said they've seen the Caspian Tiger well into the modern era as well.
Oh, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Wouldn't surprise me at all. And it's the second most mountainous country in the world after Bhutan. Which is that not a lot of people know that, but it's incredibly mountainous.
Absolutely. It's supposed to be one of, if you're into climbing, it's supposed to be one of the heavenly destinations in the world, that if you're a real climber, you've got to go to Tajikistan to test your mettle, as it were, Richard.
Yeah. So we went into the soldiers' camp, and the soldiers were all really friendly, and they'd come by at breakfast and talk to us and stuff. We went and talked to them, and apart from that one guy we spoke to, none of the others had seen tigers. They'd seen bears and wolves, but not tigers. And so we went to check the traps every day. We got nothing more, apart from that wild boar, we got no other animal other than a bat. So, you know, eventually we had to decamp. We took a different route down the valley to what we'd done before. And we'd never been this particular route. And there were very, very deep valleys with waterfalls, rivers, and very heavily treed, much more tree cover than we'd seen on different routes before. And we gave a lift to this shepherd. He was friends with our guide and our driver. We gave a lift to this guy, and his name was Daron. And he said that 5 days before, that would be the 10th of September, in the same valley we were in, that it's about 2 hours drive down from where we were. He said he was in a tent, and he heard a commotion and his dogs barking around midnight. And he came out with a torch and investigated, and he saw his dogs all around this tree, crowded around the bottom of this tree. And he called his dogs off, and shining the torch up, he saw there was a tiger in the tree. And the tiger climbed down and ran away. And that was in the same valley we were in, but 2 hours drive from where we were camped, 2 hours further down the valley, which was exciting but frustrating at the same time. And we managed to, we confirmed that the skull we saw was indeed a bear's skull, not a tiger's skull. So people are still reporting Caspian tigers in the Romit Valley right up to this day, and just accepting it as normal. To them, it never went extinct. It's just an animal that turns up now and again. And we had a couple of days back at Dushanbe, a couple of days, an hour and a half, and we went to Dushanbe Zoo, which is utterly dismal. I used to be a zookeeper at one time. I worked at Twycross Zoo, where the PG Tips chimps come from, and I ran the reptile house. And I'm a supporter of good zoos that do good conservation work, but this was a little bit like Georgetown Zoo in Guyana. When we were looking for the giant anaconda, we went to Georgetown Zoo, which was a nightmare. Things like antelopes and stuff do quite well, the plant-eating animals. They've got quite big paddocks, but they've got like a pride of lions in these concrete cells that are connected to each other, but none of them are bigger than the average living room.
Yeah.
And there's no outdoors for them. They're just like these weird concrete cells, and monkeys in little bare concrete enclosures. And they had a reptile house, and they had a West African narrow-snouted crocodile, which is a very rare animal.
Mm.
They've just got one on its own. How they got this rare species, I don't know, but they were in cramped, bare concrete enclosures as well, and the whole thing was an absolute nightmare. And Tajikistan's like a developing country, but it's developing well. It's everything seems to be going well in Tajikistan. It's very Western friendly. It's mostly all mod cons in the cities. So why they can't spend more money sorting the zoo out and getting it into a decent shape is beyond me.
Mm.
I've no idea.
Mm. It is heartbreaking sometimes. I mean,
yeah,
I've been to plenty of zoos, and how zoos are now, especially here in the UK, compared to how they were 40 or 50 years ago, Richard, you can see the vast development. I mean, we're very fortunate where we live now. We've got the wonderful Yorkshire Wildlife Park, which is just outside of Doncaster, which is incredible, really, that I've ended up with something like that on our doorstep, because it's remarkable. And some of the conservation work that they've done and the species that they've got there is remarkable. Whereas when we were kids growing up, you basically had the choice of either going all the way across to Chester to your nearest zoo or somewhere like that, or you were really struggling, really, unless you sort of push yourself out. And so whenever you did go, sometimes you'd go to these sort of attractions, and they'd have these sort of almost like an afterthought that they'd have some kind of animal enclosures, Richard, and you'd see these very sad looking animals in really tiny pens or quarters that just wasn't right for them. And you would, like you say, you know, you've got to understand that, you know, Tajikistan itself has only existed for the better part of, it's not even four decades since the fall of the Soviet Union. I think it was 91 Tajikistan got its independence, Richard. So as much as we would like it, you would probably perceive it that they don't see that as a priority right now, but obviously its economy is coming on leaps and bounds, because it's discovered that it's one of the best places for hydroelectricity because of all the mountainous regions and rivers that they've got, that they've got essentially more energy than they can use.
So I hope it'll improve in the future. On one of our previous expeditions, we met a guy who said that his grandfather had caught a tiger back in the Soviet days. I think it was in the 60s, and it had been sent to Dushanbe Zoo. Is Flamingo Land still going, isn't it?
It is.
In Yorkshire, I've never been. I don't know what it's like.
Yeah, well, that's what I was referring to as I must admit, I went as a child and I wasn't very impressed, Richard. I know it's nowhere near what it used to be, and it is quite well thought of these days, and I think that's a prime example of that. But Flamingo Land, sort of on the way to Scarborough, it's quite a way out for us denizens of South Yorkshire. But I mean, one of the things that intrigues me about this Caspian tiger situation, Richard, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, is that to all intents and purposes, the Siberian tiger is its closest living relative. Some people say they're virtually genetically identical. Is that true?
Yeah. I don't think it is, no. There's a train of thought that says that there are not all these subspecies of tiger. There are two.
Mm.
There's the mainland tigers, and then there are the island tigers. And the mainland tigers, they have races that look different. So ones from Central Asia and Siberia are hairier, and the Bengal and the Indo-Chinese and those ones, and the South Chinese are smaller because they live in warmer climates, but they're all the same. And then the subspecies were the ones that lived on the islands, the Bali tiger, which is now extinct, the Javan tiger, which is now extinct, and the Sumatran tiger. Not everybody agrees with that. I disagree with it. I think they are all distinct subspecies. And there is a suspicion that this train of thought that there are only two subspecies is to somehow lessen the importance of them, so people don't worry if they go locally extinct. That's what we suspect is going on there. But the Caspian tiger is very like the Siberian tiger, but there's a hell of a lot of land between the two of them. The Siberian tiger is right over in the east of Russia, thousands of miles from where the Caspian tiger is.
Is there any appetite in Tajikistan to reintroduce or introduce the Siberian tiger, because I know, and I know it's still ongoing, that Kazakhstan are desperate to bring tigers back, because as we're talking about what happened with the Caspian tiger, Kazakhstan was another region that was that allegedly had a massive population. I mean, the other thing is, I'm not sure if it was the same in Tajikistan, but I know in Kazakhstan, Richard, when the Soviets invaded, they just exterminated it because they saw it as a threat to agriculture. And that was one of the main driving reasons, because Kazakhstan, tigers were classed as a sacred animal. And yet the Soviets were able to convince people to hunt them to extinction, which I think is remarkable. And only less than 100 years ago, that was going on.
Like the wolves in Japan. The wolf was a sacred animal in Japan. And they wiped their wolves out. So the dwarf wolf and the honshu wolf.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah. So is the appetite the same in Tajikistan then? Because as we're talking about the subspecies and the differentials and why you think that they're not trying to sort of concern themselves with these sort of elements of the tiger family tree, are the Tajikans even interested in doing this, or are they sort of hoping that the Caspian is still hanging on in some of these regions?
I don't know what the official line is on the official government line is on the tiger, whether they believe it's still there, whether they want to introduce the Siberian. I've heard about it, a possible introducing Siberians into the former range of the Caspian, but I don't know if anything's been done. I don't think it has. It was a suggested idea, but I don't think anything's been done. I don't know what the government think of the survival of the Caspian tiger, if they think anything at all, if they've even addressed it. But the first time I came back from my first expedition to Tajikistan, we got loads and loads of eyewitness accounts of Caspian tigers from a park ranger, farmers, beekeepers, hunters, mullahs, you name it, loads of them. So I wrote all of this up, and I didn't say we'd been looking for the gull. I didn't mention relic hominins. I did say the tiger wasn't the focus of our first expedition there. We were looking for something else, but we stumbled upon all of this information on the Caspian tiger. And I did a write-up, and I sent it out to every single tiger conservation group I could find. One wrote back, and I said, this is interesting, but we only deal with the Siberian tiger. All the others didn't even grace me with an answer.
I find that baffling, Richard. I really do. I really do. I don't understand how you can be involved in the conservation of a species and not be interested in certain aspects of it. That's ridiculous. That's like saying, I really like dogs, but only black ones.
Yeah. Or like, if there was like a rhino conservation groups, and someone had gone looking for northern white rhinos, and they'd heard about all these sightings of northern white rhinos and brought them back, and they were ignored. Why are they being ignored? Together with Dr. Darren Naish and and Chris Clark and John Hare, between us, we've written a paper on anecdotal evidence for the survival of the Caspian tiger. It's not been released yet. I'm still working on it.
Mm.
But that's something that's in the pipeline. So whether that engenders any interest, I don't know. I wouldn't put money on it. But it seems totally baffling and depressing that none of these people seem to give a damn.
I think this is the strange thing when it comes to animal conservation sometimes. It all looks happy and sunny on the surface until you start to dig into it. And that's when it starts to become frustrating, because then you begin to realise that certain organisations look at things purely on a financial basis rather than the actual parameters of what animals should be saved or protected. Because it's all right sort of reintroducing certain species and on about rewilding and stuff. And you see this all the time. You see what happens in the States. You see how certain animals are mentioned over here and people sort of throw their hands in the air and clutch their pearls, Richard. Oh my God, they're on about reintroducing wolves to Scotland. Won't someone think of the children? Those kinds of excuses.
Mm.
And it's frustrating because the vast majority of wild animals know very well to steer clear of humans, because they have that sort of muscle memory that usually, unless it's based around food, bad things will happen with any interaction with humans, usually.
Yeah. A similar thing happened to a mate of mine. I've got a mate called Anthony James, and he's an artist, and he's a set designer, and he writes children's books as well. And a few years ago, there were these, do you remember when these whales got stuck in the ice? In the
yes.
Arctic, there were a family of whales, and they were trying to break away through the ice for them. And eventually, one of the calf died, but the male and the female got. I think they were grey whales.
Mm.
Got back out into the sea. You know, if you remember when that happened, he wrote a book about it. He wrote a children's book and illustrated a children's book about these whales, and how they, when the baby dies, the sky whales come for it to take it to heaven, and. He wrote this book and illustrated it, and he wrote to this whale conservation society that was involved with trying to free these whales. And he said, look, I've written this. You can have it for free. I don't want any money for it. You sell it, and what you'd make from it, put to the whale conservation. And they just ignored him.
What? That's just beyond baffling, Richard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult not to become frustrated and angry about things like this, I suppose. Mm. And, you know, we've got all these billionaires trying to pop themselves into space and constantly go on and on and on about populating Mars, which is never going to happen. I don't care what anybody says. None of these people who keep pushing themselves into space, none of these billionaires are going to live to get to Mars. And I don't think any of us are going to see it. On this side of it. It's one of those things that's just kick it down the street, Richard, and they go, oh, look, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going
to
do.
50-odd years since we first went to the moon. There's no city on the moon, is there?
No. And that, you know, and you would, when it comes to space exploration, compared to getting people to Mars, I mean, currently, if you send somebody to Mars, they're staying there. You know, that's not, there's no ifs, buts, and maybes about it. If we can't do what these people are saying they're going to do on Mars, on the moon, then it's just nonsense. And it just shows you how people are sometimes easily swayed by somebody with more money than sense telling them things that aren't going to happen. And I find it incredibly frustrating that some people prefer to look up and discuss these pipe dreams and promises that will never reach fruition, when we've got situations all around the earth where this money would be far better spent dealing with the issues we have.
How many billions have been pissed up the wall on garbage like that?
Yeah.
When that they could have been cleaning up the world's oceans, replanting the rainforests, saving endangered species, looking into genetics, into resurrecting extinct species that we've hunted into extinction.
Mm.
That's where it should be going.
Absolutely. I mean, how do the local populace view tigers, Richard? Because as I was referring to, sometimes people will get terrified when you mention certain animals such as wolves, tigers, lions, bears, whatever, because people are terrified that these creatures are all suddenly going to start breaking into people's houses and eating everyone. When it comes to Tajikistan, they've clearly had quite a symbiotic relationship with these animals previously, and it's only in modern history that the populations have been pushed to the brink of extinction. Officials will say that they are extinct, but obviously the anecdotal evidence suggests completely otherwise. Are they quite happy? Do they want them around? Do they like seeing them when they encounter them?
They just seem to accept them. In the same way as they accept bears and wolves and wild boars and lynx and other things. They're just there.
Mm.
They say they live up in the mountains. They come down to the lower areas in cold weather in winter, and that's when they take livestock. We haven't heard about them taking human beings. We've heard about leopards attacking people, but not tigers. Mm. As far as we know, only one death is attributable to a bear in Tajikistan.
Mm.
As far as we know, there's been no tiger attacks.
Mm. I mean, how large is the bear population there anyway, Richard? Is it quite substantial, or is it...
The bear population is quite substantial, yeah. The first time we were there, we photographed bears with our camera traps. The second time we found loads of bear droppings all over the place. We never actually saw a bear, but even when we went out walking at night, but we saw evidence of them. So the bear population in Tajikistan is quite healthy. So is the wolf population.
And you would suggest that the tiger is perfectly aligned as an apex predator alongside those two, wouldn't you?
Yes, yeah. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Caspian tiger is not only still around in Tajikistan, but it's in the neighbouring countries too.
Mm. Well, this is the thing as well, because obviously the position that Tajikistan has and the areas it inhabits, these are areas that aren't very well explored anyway, certainly by the Western scientific community, Richard. It seems perplexing often that creatures are dismissed as being extinct because nobody can be bothered to look for them.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot. Well, the pink-headed duck, I knew a guy called Richard Thorns, and off his own bat, he'd gone looking for the pink-headed duck in Burma, which is, you know, is the sort of totalitarian, authoritarian country these days. And he'd gone to places where the tourists aren't supposed to go. He got places where he shouldn't have been. He got people to take him there.
Yeah.
And he hasn't seen, but he's spoke to loads of people that have seen them and identified them from photographs and pictures he's took. So I think a lot of these things that we say are thought of are extinct are still around. I mean, the main one is the Tasmanian wolf, which I think is
yes,
still in the west of Tasmania, possibly on the mainland, probably in New Guinea as well.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is frustrating often that people just dismiss this because, as you say, the Tasmanian wolf, Tasmanian tiger, I think people just presume Australia's as big as Ireland sometimes, the way they speak about it, Richard, because you've got, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of miles with next to no bugger living there at all. Yeah. Yes, it's quite arid and unhot, but as famously quoted in Jurassic Park, nature finds a way all the time. And there are certain areas. I mean, I remember once saying on a show about how remote certain parts of Tasmania were, and this somebody from Australia said, "No, that's rubbish. Everywhere in parts of Tasmania ever." I've seen documentaries where they've gone to these abandoned locations and lakes and places in Tasmania, which you would, because this is the other thing. There's no lakes in Australia. This is the key thing. You've got some big rivers and rather substantial bodies of water, but nothing that would be technically classed as a lake, as Tony Healy advised me. And so, whereas Tasmania's got a couple of big ones. And so sometimes it surprises me how little people know of their local areas, even though, you know, I don't know every aspect of what lives in South Yorkshire, Richard. And if I said, oh, no, there's no such thing as that in South Yorkshire, I'd be talking out my arse.
Yeah. Well, in Tasmania, Tasmania's the size of Ireland. It's got a population of less than 500,000. most of whom live in Hobart or Launceston.
Yeah.
Their towns are the size of villages. Their villages are the size of hamlets. And when you get out to the west of the island, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of square miles of wilderness.
Yeah.
Like the Franklin Gordon wilderness. No one lives there.
Mm.
And if you're talking about a nocturnal animal that's the size of a coyote, a solitary hunter, then, you know, you can't rule that out.
So, I mean, when looking at this from the Centre of Forestry and Zoology's perspective then, Richard, would you consider the latest exhibition to be a success? Were you intrigued? Did you find enough anecdotal evidence from people to give you a thirst for knowledge that 2, 3, 4 years down the line, it's worth reinvestigating? Do you think that there is a real possibility that it's just a question of looking in the right areas? Because if anything, the one thing most people will know, whether it's a domestic cat to a tiger, they are wonderful at keeping out of the way if they don't want to be seen. And it doesn't matter what size of a cat is, Richard. I mean, there's numerous examples from India, particularly, of people on elephants looking for certain creatures, and tigers just seem to appear from absolutely nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty convinced that the Caspian tiger is out there. And as I've said with other things, I think it's probably less endangered, although the paradox is it's considered extinct. But with the amount of sightings of it, I think it's probably more common than things like the South China tiger.
Hmm.
And the Sumatran tiger, there's about 600 of them left. But I've said before, when I was talking about the Tasmanian wolf, I think there's probably more of them left than there are of the Javan rhino or the Sumatran rhino. Hmm. And I think there's probably more of the Caspian tiger left than the Sumatran rhino or the Javan rhino. Because with the Javan rhino, the Javan rhino and the Sumatran rhino, there's probably less than 100 left in the world of each of them.
Yeah.
And I should imagine there's a lot more Tasmanian wolves and a lot more Caspian tigers, even though they're classified as extinct, which is the weird paradox.
Yes. Well, this is the thing. I think this is one of the other aspects as well, that people seem to think that the word extinct means that's it, whereas usually it means, well, we've not really found much evidence over the last few years, and therefore, unless we have a proper investigation and an expedition to really put people down there for months on end, Richard, there's very little chance of actually proving it, until you get a situation where perhaps such a creature gets run over, or they find one that's passed away through a variety of reasons, and often that's when things come back. You only have to look what's been going on about the night parrot in Australia over the last 5 years.
Yes, that was thought to be extinct for decades. Absolutely decades that was thought to have been extinct.
Yeah, it makes that guy who got into some trouble over it all, because that made me laugh, because you had that chap, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, who claimed he could prove that they existed, and he got a feather and whatever, and that was that. And then I was reading about 3 months ago, they've just found a massive flock of them, haven't they?
Yeah.
They were there all along. And that just shows you, they were there, right in the smack of people's faces, and they just didn't realise.
Mm.
Because parrots aren't the quietest of creatures to disappear either, Richard, are they?
No, they just lived in a remote part of the desert.
Yeah. So do you think long-term, as Tajikistan's economy improves and things like that, Richard, they'll start to think about revitalising some of these former creatures, or perhaps creating protected areas for them in, as you say, this particular area where you've been over the last 3 expeditions that seems to be a bit of a hotbed for the locals encountering such creatures against the face of the scientific evidence that's in the modern world?
Yeah, well, I hope they will, because it's an up-and-coming tourist area. It's one of those countries that is developing its tourism, and I think that wildlife tourism will be a big thing for them.
Mm.
We met some people, they were from Dushanbe, but they'd been up into the Ramit Valley on a tourist thing in their own country, and I said they'd seen, they had a great time, they'd seen bears and wolves and really enjoyed it. So I think it's an up and coming thing, and there will be more wildlife tourism happening in Tajikistan, and hopefully they'll spend more money on conservation, and hopefully the Caspian tiger will be rediscovered.
Mm. Well, I mean, even from your personal experience, Richard, obviously what happened on one of your previous expeditions where you went looking for the Oran Pendek and accidentally discovered a species of big cat that wasn't supposed to be where it was. It just shows you sometimes a lot of it's down to luck as well, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with the Sumatran tiger, we know it's not extinct. There's supposed to be about 600 of them, but it was in an area where they had never been recorded before. So either there's an undiscovered population or the known population is expanding out into other areas, which either way, it's important and interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, things like that are groundbreaking because one way or another, that just flies in the face of what people have been saying for decades about the Sumatran tiger, that there's either a population that people are not aware of once again in a location that perhaps people are not looking for it properly, or they've wised up to the fact and just keep out of the way.
Mm. Yeah, but it's a very, very important discovery either way.
Mm. I mean, what was the overall response to that? Because I remember when it happened and you were teasing me about where it was. Have they found the Oran Pendek? I mean, I was just as excited to see this, Richard, because I think, as we're saying there, it's as important just because it's not one of these legendary cryptids that everybody wants to discover. Doesn't mean it's not as important. When you find a creature that's not supposed to be where it is, then that's remarkable, especially when we're talking about animals under such extreme pressures of habitat and environment.
Mm. It's a remarkable discovery, but outside of the people that follow what we do, nobody seems to be interested. A documentary has been made about it, which... Mm. Hopefully will be spread the word around more. It hasn't been released yet, but I've seen an advanced copy of it, and they talk about the tiger in that and show the film that we took.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Mmm, fabulous, fabulous. So is it something that you're wanting to get back out there? Would you go somewhere else in the region, Richard? Like I was talking about Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan as other places it was known to go.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a case of going to other countries if you can and seeing if they've still got these sort of records and experiences from the locals? Because obviously these are the people who are going to encounter it more, not your people in your major cities, as you referred to earlier. These, even though they live in the country, they've gone on a holiday in their own country to see creatures that they would never have normally known were there.
Yeah. Well, we're planning at some point to go back to the Romit Valley again, to the area where this tiger was seen in the tree. I'd love to go to some of the others as well. We've got vague, just forming plans afoot to return to Tasmania. I'm involved with some discussion with a French and German television company about a TV series where we go looking for gigantic crocodiles around the world, some of the biggest crocodiles. And whether that comes off or not, I don't know. It'd be nice if it did.
Yeah.
But all these things, you know how these television things are. There's so many of them that get talked about and nothing's ever done. But it's a possibility. We've got our fingers crossed on that. It all depends down to funding. It's all down to funding and time and things things of that nature. If, you know, if I won the lottery and I was set up for life, I could do several expeditions a year for the rest of my life. There's so much work to do. There's so much things that need investigating.
Well, I wish you all the best in any future endeavours. I mean, have you got any expeditions planned next year with the CFZ? Richard, have you drawn up which continent you're fancying visiting next on the trail of something strange?
Well, we want to go back to Tasmania. We want to do Iriomote Island, which is off the sun coast of Japan, where there's an undiscovered species of big cat, which may be a dwarf island form of the clouded leopard. Mm. We want to do Flores for Homo floresiensis, eastern end of Flores. There are reports of these tiny hominins. Another place we want to do. And obviously, we want to get back to Tasmania. We want to go back to Tajikistan. I want to do these crocodile things. How many of them pan out? Anybody's guess, but we've got our fingers crossed.
Fabulous. Well, I mean, obviously, as I referred to at the beginning, Richard, you've had two books near enough come out at the same time this year. You had Creatures That Eat People and obviously The Highest Strangeness, which are both radically different and yet as compelling as each other, depending how much you want to dwell on people being devoured or people seeing terrifyingly strange creatures from around the world. So I know when we spoke last time, you were on about that there's going to be a sequel to The Creatures That Eat People. So do you know when that is that going to be released next year, my friend?
That's autumn of next year. So it's quite a ways off. It's written ages ago. Mm. But why they're not releasing it until next autumn is probably financial reasons. But that's going to be out next autumn. It'll be called Creatures That Eat People, Volume 2. I hate the name. I wanted to call it Beasts That Prey on Man, which is much more poetic and lyrical. Mm-hmm. Creatures That Eat People sounds like it's been made up by a 10-year-old. I'm about to start work on the sequel to High Strangeness, mm-hmm. because there was stuff that happened after I'd written High Strangeness, like the Waverley Abbey Dragons case. Stuff I found out about that I hadn't put in the books, I didn't know since then. Historic cases I didn't know about, and stuff I just couldn't fit in. So I'm going to be writing a second one. Working title is Strange Cases. Mm. And in this one, it's not going to be so much about the analysis of them, which we've done in the first book. It's just going to be extra cases, extra weird cases. Mm. Recording them rather than a deep dive analysis like the first one was.
Fabulous. So other than that, and as I mentioned, your next big appearances, obviously UncannyCon. What's 2025 got in store for you, Richard? Have you already got some speaking engagements lined up? I know you're a regular speaker at Weird Weekend normally. Are you returning for 2025?
Yes, I'll be talking on the Caspian Tiger in 2025 and on the Waverley Abbey Dragons case.
Mm.
I keep saying to you, you need to come to that. And every year he says, oh, I'm going to come. And you haven't managed it yet.
Next year's my year, Richard. I'm telling you now, mate. I've got a few things lined up. And I'm speaking at a couple of events already next year. I've already been invited to do a couple as well. So I'm completely clear that weekend for this time. So I will definitely get myself over the border and enjoy watching you eat some lard or whatever Glenn's decided you're going to try and consume this year, my friend. So we'll definitely make it next year.
Yeah. And then there's I'm going to be at the Hebden Bridge Folklore Society. We do a talk on dragons, Monday dragon sightings, on February the 22nd next year in Yorkshire. So I'll send you the details of that because it's Yorkshire, so you might be able to make it.
Strangely enough, Hebden Bridge is one of those places that I've recently been wanting to revisit, Richard, because I've not been there for 20, 30 years, and I know for a fact it's nothing like it was when I went there as a younger person. It's a bit like Todmorden. It's kind of embraced folklore in a way that's quite surprising.
I'll send you the details on that. And then there's a guy I know, a friend of mine. We're in discussion about doing a big Fortean conference at this rural pub down in the south.
Yeah.
I'm damned if I can remember where it is now without going and looking at his emails. But
it's in Wiltshire.
That's it. Because you were one of the people I put forward.
Yes, he's been in touch. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah. Yeah. as one of the speakers, because he wants to do as the 14 times unconvention used to be. He used to be thinking of doing one of these 3-day events once a year, and he runs events. He runs like theatre and stuff like that, so he knows what he's doing, and it'll be a big old thing. And if it gets off the ground, it could be like a replacement for unconvention, much in the same way that Weird Weekend is, because more 14 conventions around the country can only be a good thing, because you know, you get one-off day events here and there, but you get very few yearly multi-day conventions. I mean, the only real one going now is the Weird Weekend. So if we can get another one going, so we've got one in the north and one in the south, that would be really good. So he's approaching all sorts of people. I gave him a long list of 14, as yourself included, of people to approach as speakers. So what do you think? Would you be interested in doing that?
I've already said yes. So basically we've both got very hectic schedules for the next 2 or 3 weeks, but we're going to sit down and have a chat about things. But thank you. Yes.
I'm having a meeting with him when I'm going back to Nuneaton for a few days for my mother's birthday, and we're going to have a meeting while I'm up there. Yeah. So, hopefully that'll come off.
Yes, fingers crossed, because you never know, there might be another one next summer as well, Richard, but I can't say much more at this time.
Oh, well, count me in.
Don't worry, you're on my list. well, Richard, thank you as always. It's
all right, yeah.
Refreshing and as earnest as ever, my friend, in regards to this. And it's nice to talk about these creatures. Sometimes, you know, obviously we tend to specialise in some of the stranger aspects of the animal kingdom. But I think, for me, I love animals, and I love the search to prove that some of these wonderful and beautiful creatures are still with us. And this is a prime example of that with the Caspian tiger. So for anybody who's wanting to catch up with your more recent releases and books in general, where can everybody find you and keep up to date with what you're up to, my friend?
We can go to the CFZ website, Centre for 14 Zoology website, www.cfz.org.uk. You can find my books online. You can order them from any good bookshop, or probably any crap bookshop as well. But you can find them on eBay and Amazon. If you just type in Richard Freeman, my latest ones are the awfully named Creatures That Eat People and The Highest Strangeness. So those are my latest two. But I've written 10, and I've got another couple on the way and an idea for another one after that. So all depends on how much time I get to write them.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything as always. And I just want to say thank you again for your support, your continued fascinating conversations, and sharing some insights in regards to the work that you do when you go on your expeditions with your colleagues in the CFZ, Richard. And I wish you the very best for the rest of the year, and hopefully we'll speak soon.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having us.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.